morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for a half hour each weekday morning to take your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith and would like to air those questions here and have them discussed with us, we'd love to hear from you today. If you have heard comments by this host on this program before, which you think are not accurate or not responsible or can be improved upon, feel free to call and improve upon them. We will not be have any hurt feelings here. If you know more than I do, that's great, excellent. We would like to depend on those who know the most about the Bible to gain understanding of it. So feel free to call and bring correction if you see it. The number to call is 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Let's talk first of all to Sandy from San Jose, who also called us yesterday. Hey, Sandy, good to hear from you again.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Steve. Appreciate it. I'll try to be brief today. It's a similar question to that which I asked yesterday, specifically regarding the Olivet Discourse, Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Yeah.
What was the historical context? I'm sorry. What was the majority opinion on that through Christian millennia? What was the overall belief? To me, it seems very obvious that Jesus was saying, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. So what was the majority opinion on that through church history?
Yeah, well, once again, as with your question yesterday, it's almost impossible to say what the majority opinion was, since we don't have any word recorded from the majority of the Christians or even the majority of the Christian leaders. We do have some, though. We know that Eusebius, who wrote in 325 A.D., was one of the earliest church historians, in fact, the earliest we know about, except for Luke, who wrote the book of Acts. Of course, Luke was earlier. But Eusebius, writing at the same time as the Nicene Council, wrote a history of the church up to his time. And I think he's the earliest writer we know of who commented on the meaning of the Olivet Discourse. At least he's the earliest I know about. And he is describing in his history how that Jerusalem was besieged by the Romans and fell in AD 70. And Eusebius applies that to Matthew 24. He actually quotes from Matthew 24 a couple of passages saying, you know, the Lord actually predicted that this would happen. And he's talking about AD 70 in the context, and he quotes from those passages. Now, how views may have changed over the years after his time, I'm not sure. I'm not sure we have the ability to document that. But I know that in, the 17 and 1800s, every commentary I've been able to find that talks about the Olivet Discourse applies it to AD 70. I don't really know. Now, there may have been some, but I don't know of any commentators who applied the Olivet Discourse to the end of the world until the rise of dispensationalism in the 19th century.
Okay. I mean, it seems, you know, one of the things the dispensational have their hermeneutic, I forgot exactly what it is, but it's something like, you know, take the literal meaning if it becomes obvious in its plain literal sense. You've heard that before with how they have their...
Yeah, well, that is the hermeneutic of dispensationalism. Yeah, they say take it literally whenever possible.
And to me, this verse is so obviously literal, I just don't get how they go in a different direction, but...
Yeah, I know. I mean, right. The discourse begins with Jesus being asked about when the temple will be destroyed. I mean, begins with him predicting the temple being destroyed and not one stone being left standing on another. And then the disciples ask him, when will this be and what sign will there be that that's about to happen? So very clearly, they're asking him about the destruction of the temple. History has shown that it was destroyed by the Romans in A.D. 70. And Jesus' comments fit that perfectly.
It does. Yeah, you must have to go out of your way to not see it, in my opinion. But that's really it.
It depends on who taught you first. You know, when you're a new Christian, if you're sitting under teachers who tell you that that's about the tribulation and the end of the world,
right,
you don't know any better. You know, you figure, well, these guys know the Bible better than I do. I'm speaking for myself. When I was young, and I heard teachers say those things, I thought, well, my teachers, they know the Bible really well, and I don't.
Right.
So I guess they must be right about this. And what we don't realize is that they're not teaching you what most Christians have believed about the Bible. They're teaching you what their particular party believes about it, which is a relatively modern party.
You know, and one last comment regarding kind of the literal translation, because I grew up under first the Assemblies of God, and then you know my current denomination.
Yes.
And the Assemblies are dispensational, too. And one of the things they said, take the Bible literally, you know. And so years ago, when I would hear something like reading in Exodus or one of the first five books where it says, and they built a altar, and it's there to this day, you know, I go, well, that must be there today, you know.
That's right.
I literally did. And, you know, so now I've become educated anyway. At least I think I'm educated.
You know, I thought that way when I was a kid, too. When I was a kid and I'd read, I mean, there's lots of times when Abraham built an altar or the Joshua set up these stones or whatever it says, and they are there to this day. I actually thought, you know, I thought of the Bible as sort of a magical book that speaks to all times equally. And I thought, well, wow, they must still be there today because it says they're there to this day. And I didn't realize that these books were written by people living at a certain time, speaking to the people of their time and telling the people of their time. Those are still there right now. But, of course, now we're reading 3,000 years later, 4,000 years later. They're not still there now.
But the principle, which is the part that's important, is what they did is they set up memorials to remember what God has done. And in a similar way, we're to do that. We look back at things that God's done in my life, and I set up a memorial. So the principle there, it's just that the memorial probably 2,000, 4,000 years ago isn't there. So anyway. Hey, Steve, as always, thanks. Appreciate your ministry, and let someone else get on today, okay?
Okay, Cindy. Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Good talking to you, brother.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, bye now. All right, you're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. We have a line open for you at 1-800-227-5278. And I just want to mention before we run out of time, and we do run out of time very quickly on the program here, because it's only a half hour. Therefore, call now. Don't wait, because we'll run out of time. This Saturday, I guess that's tomorrow, isn't it? This Friday? This is Friday today. So this Saturday, tomorrow, I will be conducting a gathering in La Palma, which is in Orange County. And it's a home gathering, and it's going to be an open Bible discussion following a potluck dinner. You can come for the potluck and the meeting, or you can just come for the meeting if you'd like to. That's tomorrow night in La Palma. And if you don't know where that is, I think it's out. I think it's out in the neighborhood of Brea and or Anaheim. I haven't really been there yet. This is going to be our first time meeting in that location, but we do have a map to it at our website and address and all those things. So if you're interested in going there tomorrow night and meeting some of our listeners, you can go to thenarrowpath.com. That's our website, thenarrowpath.com, and click the link that says announcements. And you'll find all the information you need to join us there tomorrow. Be glad to meet you. Let's talk to James from Los Angeles next. James, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning, sir. Did Jesus ever refer to Adam and Eve? And if so, that would lead me to believe that there is a literal truth to Adam and Eve. And if so, I thought I heard you say that the Catholic Church may not be acknowledging the literal truth of creation, and I don't know how they could do that if Jesus refers to the creation and Adam and Eve. Could you comment on that, please?
Well, first of all, Jesus did refer to Adam and Eve in Matthew chapter 19 when he was asked about the conditions for divorce. And he said, have you not read that he that made them in the beginning made them male and female and said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and these two should become one flesh.
Exactly.
He's quoting from Genesis 2:24. And they said, yeah, then why did Moses give a command to give a bill of divorcement to put her away? And Jesus said, well, because of the hardness of your hearts, God permitted you to divorce. But he said, from the beginning it was not so. Now, that statement, from the beginning it was not so, is a reference back to Genesis. He's saying that the way that Genesis describes it is the way it was. And so Jesus does confirm that Adam and Eve were literal. In fact, if he didn't take them literally, then there'd be no argument he'd be making there. He's trying to argue that divorce is wrong because God made the two one flesh, and he quotes Genesis 2 as the proof of that. So if that's not a true story, then Jesus' comment is not true, and it doesn't make his point form at all. Now,
right.
I never said that the Catholic Church doesn't believe in the creation story. In fact, I don't remember that subject ever coming up on this program.
Well, I was kind of confused. I mean, the evolution story. Did you ever say anything about evolution? I'm not defending the church. I'm just trying to...
Right. No, I've never actually made any reference to the Roman Catholics' views of those things. I do know of Christians who believe in some form of evolution. I don't. That is, I don't believe in grand scale evolution. I think everybody in the world believes that there's small changes that take place, what we call microevolution. But I don't believe that evolution explains the origin of species.
I apologize. I might have misunderstood you. I thought I heard you say about the Catholic Church something to do with some acceptance of the general evolution concept.
No, it's possible. It's possible that you were listening to another program where somebody made that comment, because it is the case that the Pope some decades ago, I think it was back in the 80s, some kind of an announcement that it's all right for Catholics to believe in evolution. And I never mentioned that on this show. I mean, it hasn't ever come up here on this show for me to mention it. But it's possible you were listening to some other show and the host mentioned that.
Oh, I apologize. So if in fact the church accepts or allows people the Catholics to accept evolution, that's sort of like denying what Jesus said, basically, when he talked about Adam and Eve.
It actually depends on how they understand evolution. Some people believe evolution took place up to a certain point, but then when Adam and Eve came along, that God did something special in their case and actually created Adam and Eve. But there are people who don't accept the idea of a literal Adam and Eve, and who think that that's like a parable or a myth or something like that. And I don't agree with them. I believe that Adam and Eve were literal characters.
I believe Adam and Eve and the whole story of creation by the Bible is literal. Would you happen to know if the Catholic Church, maybe you don't know, but would you happen to know how they feel generally about the Adam and Eve, the true creation from the Bible, the story in the Bible?
I'm not sure how the Catholics would generally hold on that, but like I said, the Pope did announce back in the 80s that if there's nothing contrary to Roman Catholicism in believing that evolution occurred. They would believe, of course, that God made evolution occur. They wouldn't believe in atheistic evolution, of course, but they would believe in what we call theistic evolution. I appreciate your call, James, and we're going to talk next to Wynn from Palos Verdes, California. Wynn, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Question has to do with the Olivet Discourse that you discussed earlier. It is true that Jesus was asked about the destruction of the temple, but along with the question, there's also a question on what are the signs of your coming and of the end of the world. And from what Jesus answered, he did say, like, there will be earthquakes, there will be people coming in my name. So I'm just wondering, because you believe these already happened in 70 A.D., but did they actually happen?
They did.
Like, in Luke, you talk a little bit different. You also talk about people will faint from the roaring of the sea, and also Jerusalem will be occupied by the Gentile until the time is fulfilled. And all these things, are they truly already happened before 70 A.D.? And also at the end, Jesus did talk about that he would come on a cloud.
Let me address that, if I could, before we run out of time here. And I want to talk to also Vicky, our next caller, who wants to talk about the mark of the beast. So a lot of people want to talk about end times type stuff, it looks like. But let me try to give you an answer as briefly as I can. And I will say this, if this answer is too brief, there is a very extensive answer. You can get free from my website if you go to thenarrowpath.com and click on the link that says Topical Lectures. you'll find that among the many lectures that are there, there's a set of lectures called When Shall These Things Be? Which is obviously a question the disciples asked that led to the Olivet Discourse. And you'll find that there's several lectures there about the Olivet Discourse. And you'll find that, yes, indeed, those things did happen. The earthquakes, the famines, the wars and rumors of wars, the false prophets, the false Christs, all of those things, in fact, did happen before 70 AD. There's documentation of it. Some of that documentation is in the Bible, some like in the book of Acts. Some of it is in secular documents of the time from the Romans and such. But when the disciples said, what is the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? I believe the end of the age refers to the end of the Jewish age, which did come to an end with the destruction of the temple. It ended Judaism, as it had been known in the Bible for 1,400 years previously. His coming, what did they mean by what is the sign of your coming? Now, we, of course, think of his coming as his second coming. Every time we read that term, we think of the second coming. But did the disciples know about the second coming? Would they be asking about his second coming? They didn't even know he was going away, much less that he was going to come back. We're sometimes reading into their language things that we now understand, and we assume they must have understood. When they say, what is the sign of your coming? It's very unlikely that they meant, what is the sign of your second coming? Since they had no concept of his second coming at that point. They wouldn't likely ask about something they'd never heard about or didn't understand. Remember, when Jesus was risen from the dead, they said, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? And they thought he was going to stay and start setting up the kingdom. But instead he went away, and then the angels told him he's going to come back again. That took them by surprise. So I don't think that in the Olivet Discourse they're asking him about his second coming. They're asking him about his coming in judgment, which is a term that the Old Testament uses quite a bit, and they were Jews. So they understood the Old Testament somewhat. They at least knew the language of the Old Testament. The Old Testament uses the language of God coming when it's talking about a national judgment on someone like Babylon or Egypt or Edom or Israel. When a nation was judged by God, usually it was not through supernatural means, it was usually through war. But still, the Old Testament prophets spoke of that as God coming, and God visiting, and God judging. And it's likely that when Jesus had described the destruction of the temple, that the disciples had no reason to associate that with his second coming, since that was a foreign concept to them at that time. But rather, they would think of that in the Old Testament sense of him coming in judgment upon the nation that had rejected him, which, of course, would really, in history, look like an army coming, just like in the Old Testament usages. Now, I do believe in the second coming. I need to make that clear, because whenever I make this point about Revelation or the Olivet Discourse, people think, oh, you don't believe in the second coming. No, let's not jump to conclusions. Of course I believe in the second coming. Paul talked about the second coming. James, Peter, others talked about the second coming. But not everything in the Bible talks about the second coming. And in my opinion, the disciples' question was not about the second coming. And while it is true that the Olivet Discourse includes statements by Jesus about, you know, then they'll see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory and so forth, that those very words are used in the Old Testament of judgments that occurred in Egypt and other places in the Old Testament when the Assyrians came or the Babylonians came or someone else came and judged them. You see, we have to remember that the disciples were not Americans. They didn't talk like Americans. They talked like Jews. They were Jews. And they had the Old Testament as the basis of their thinking and talking about such subjects. So if you want a long answer about this with details, feel free to go to my website, thenarrowpath.com. Click on the link that says Topical Lectures. And once you're there, find the series of lectures called When Shall These Things Be? And then you can look at the titles, the names of the lectures, and you'll see which ones are about the Olivet Discourse, and you'll get a very thorough examination of these things. We're going to have to, unfortunately, move along here. It's a big subject, but we don't have really time to go into it in much detail as I'd like. But I appreciate your call, Wynn. Let's talk to Vicki before we're out of time here from Los Angeles. Vicki, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Apostle, thank you for the ministry that you've been called to before the foundation of the world. But I wanted to ask, okay, in Revelation 24, it says, I saw a throne on which was seated those who have been given authority to judge, and I saw the souls of those who have been beheaded because of their testimony for Jesus and because of the word of God. they did not worship the beast or the image. Okay, the Bible says that we can't serve two masters, so I was wondering, the people that will be beheaded because they didn't take the mark, are those the people that was not taken up in the rapture? You know, some people, they're going to church, you know, they're saying that they're Christians, but they're living like the world. So my question is, are those people that's going to be beheaded, are those the ones that's actually going to be left behind, you know, knowing the word, but, you know, didn't live the way Christ required us to live?
I hear you.
Right,
I understand.
Are those other people that's going to accept Christ, you know, after the church is taken up?
Okay. Well, first of all, there's some presuppositions that you're making that are somewhat different than the presuppositions I'm making about the passage. For one thing, and I don't blame you for this because this is something that probably most people do, but you're apparently assuming that the book of Revelation is about the end times. And this is a view, this is one of four views that are out there. It's the view that is probably most popular today. In fact, most of the people listening to me probably have heard that view, and maybe only that view. What they would be surprised to find out is if you were a Protestant living more than 200 years ago, 200 years ago to ever before, you would never have heard of that view. You would never have heard of the idea that the book of Revelation is talking about the end times. There are four other views that have been prominent and are still prominent. At least three of the four are still prominent today. And one of the views is, of course, the view that you hold that Revelation is about the end times. And, you know, you're going to find the tribulation and the rapture and the Antichrist and the end times and so forth. And that's how many people understand Revelation. More commonly in the past, people believed that Revelation was talking about the whole age of the church, one way or the other. Either a panorama of the whole time from John's day to the end of the world, that's called the historicist view. Or the idealist view, which holds that it's talking about the whole age of the church from a heavenly point of view, talking about principles and movements and ideals that are true at all times through the whole church age and are not necessarily applicable to the end of the world. Those are two alternative views. There's also another alternative view called the preterist view, which holds that the book of Revelation was predicting the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 and the fall of the Jewish state and the Jewish religion. Those three views exist and are still held by very, very excellent scholars. They always have been. There's always been excellent scholars and Christians who hold these different views, but most of us have never heard them. The futurist view is the view that you've heard and that I heard growing up. And I wrote a book back in 1997, which is still available from Amazon and other places like that, called Revelation Four Views, a Parallel Commentary. And if you wish to understand the possible understandings of Revelation additional to your own, I would highly recommend that you get a hold of that book, which not just because I wrote it, but because it compares them quite objectively side by side, and you could become more aware of the other options. I do not hold the futurist view, which I used to hold and which you hold, and therefore I don't think that Revelation is talking about the rapture, the tribulation, or the end of the world. But many people believe that there will be a rapture of the church, and after the rapture of the church there will be people who will be saved, Jews and Gentiles. 144,000 Jews and an innumerable company of Gentiles, and that the Antichrist will persecute these people, and if they do not worship him, they'll get their heads cut off. And those people who believe that way, which are called dispensationalists, also believe that the people in Revelation 20 who had their heads cut off and are now seen enthroned are those people. So in answer to your question, the dispensational view, which is the view that you've heard, would in fact agree with that suggestion that you made, that those who are reigning in Revelation 20 are those who got converted during the tribulation. Or maybe, as you suggested as an alternative, maybe they got saved before the tribulation but were so compromised in their Christian walk that they didn't make it in the rapture. And so they had to go into the tribulation and be martyred. My own view is that the rapture is not going to come prior to the end of the world. The rapture is going to come when Jesus comes back. Everything in the Bible that mentions the rapture, and it's not much. I mean, you've got 1 Corinthians 15 and 1 Thessalonians 4 is about it. But wherever the rapture is mentioned, it is placed at the end of the world. It is placed at the second coming of Christ. Jesus spoke of raising up his people, which would be the resurrection, but also the rapture. In John 6, he said he'd raise them up on the last day. So I believe, as Jesus and the apostles said, that the rapture of the church and the resurrection of the saints will take place on the last day, not 7 years before, not 3.5 years before, not any interval before, but on the last day, Jesus will come and raise us up. But the pre-tribulation rapture view, which is apparently the view you're aware of, believes the rapture of the church will take place 7 years before the end of the world, or before the end of this present age. And then there will be 7 more years of calamity on the earth, and that the church will miss out on that because the rapture will take place first. I used to teach that myself, but I was shocked to learn after many years of teaching it that it's not taught anywhere in the Bible, and that it's an extremely new view in terms of church history. My teachers didn't tell me that, which was, I think, not very honest of them. Anyway, I want to be honest with you and just let you know that there are other ways to see it. The Bible says, he that is first in his own cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. And so I would like to be able to cross-examine things we've been taught so that we don't believe something that merely seems right for lack of our understanding the other options. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. I'll see some of you in La Palma tomorrow. The rest of you, have a good weekend. God bless.